Hi, I'm your host, Andrew Sanders.
And hi, I'm your co-host, Flo Labrato.
And welcome to Different at Work, where we talk about how we get to be different at work. Here, we discuss navigating the modern workplace and cultivating professional relationships while being wired a little differently.
We're here to help people in their journey of becoming themselves fully by pairing informative science, theories, and practices with practical lived experience context, using the strengths that come with how our brains work.
And today we're going to explore a tough experience, the choice to disclose or not to disclose your diagnosis in the workplace. So what's it like to consider whether or not to say something to the people you work with or not?
And this is a really important and sensitive moment. I think about it from the point of view of the leader or manager, and I'll bring that to the conversation to talk to what it's like when someone that you lead, that someone that's in your care professionally in the workplace, approaches you to share something so big, whether it's a learning disability or autism or ADHD or dyslexia or anything else. So I'm really excited to get into this topic. Andrew, I'm curious about, because your journey was different. Like, you learned about your ADHD after you had moved into your own business. You're your own boss. So it's a little different. But I'm curious about, like, what are some of the thoughts that might run through someone's mind when making that decision, whether to choose to say something or keep it to themselves?
Yeah, and this is a very tricky topic because we talked a little bit in previous episodes about RSD, and my RSD part of my brain tells me I don't want to give anybody else any excuses or reasons to reject me or think I'm less than other people. And there's still a stigma attached to ADHD. Even myself, before my diagnosis, kind of had the stereotype in my head of what ADHD or ADD was, right? So do I really want to put myself out there and, you know, give somebody else some rope, some ammunition to load that rejection cannon, right? But I also know that there are a lot of advantages to how the ADHD brain is wired, right? I call them my superpowers. So I came across one study that the ADHD brain actually, you know, might take us longer to get initiated into a project or start working on it. But once we do, we are like 2 to 4 times more productive than that non-ADHD brain. So you can imagine if you create an environment that is conducive for that type of person to work, the type of output that you can see from them, right? So if you right fit the person with the role that they're in and create an atmosphere of, you know, the novelty in a healthy way, you can create such synergy with the person in the role and what they're doing. But that is a double-edged sword because you don't quite know how your disclosure of your diagnosis is going to be received by the other person. And once you ring that bell, once you say those words, you can't unring it.
There's no take backs. And I think about how much is at risk. Like, let's talk about something even completely different, an experience that women often have in the workplace of when is the right time to share about a pregnancy because of concerns about what that might do in the workplace. How are people going to see her? Are people going to question her level of commitment and all these other things? So I think about so many things that could be at risk or at stake when making the choice. But then on the other hand, as I hear you share this, there could be so many advantages to sharing the diagnosis, taking the risk and disclosing to get the support. Hopefully you have, if this is you, hopefully you have a very supportive manager, leader in a very supportive culture and organization. But to be able to get that kind of support to design work in a way that works for you does require saying something. But then there's the flip side of that, because so much of the conversation is putting the responsibility on the person, whether it's autism, ADHD, dyslexia, anything else, right? There's so much responsibility that is placed on them to disclose for them, and really no one else can share that information other than the individual. But there's so much responsibility. Like, for example, almost anyone who's worked in a medium, a large organization, you probably have seen somewhere in the HR system where someone asks you to confirm any part of your identity, whether, you know, veteran status or disability or ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, and so on. And while much of this may be related to for managing, you know, diversity or managing equitable hiring process, federal law, all of that, just even I could even imagine just clicking the button to acknowledge something has risk, even more so saying it to your manager.
Yeah.
But the responsibility, yes, is on the individual to I can't make someone say something, right? But on the flip side, let's talk about the responsibility of leaders in an organization to make it easy for someone to disclose.
Yeah, I'm going to have some questions here because it is one of the things that I've learned about myself and processing my ADHD is that I am distrustful of people at large, but super overly trusting of people that I know. And that's an interesting thing to have to work through, right? So public at large, you know, I'm very off put by having to deal with people I don't know. I'm not going to be inclined to believe a stranger on the street about anything, right? Or social media posts or whatever. But if you've shown me any sort of kindness or familiarity and I know you, like I can overtrust you. And I've been burned by that. And, you know, in our last episode talking about reprocessing, there's a lot of those interactions that I have kind of reprocessed and like, oh, okay, wait a minute. That was somebody that I trusted a little bit too much. And I was quick to overshare, right? So there's that word oversharing. That's the context of why I'm bringing it in this conversation. Like, how do we balance the inclination to maybe overshare with, I don't know, I need to think through how I word that question because like
maybe
you're
the
right.
Balance of vulnerability versus excessive disclosure. And those are not my words. I'm borrowing Brené Brown's words in case there is.
Yeah, it's a tricky subject, right? I am wired to want to trust people in my immediate vicinity because like I know them and if they've showed me positive encouragement, then that kind of triggers the people pleasing in my brain, which my brain also confuses with the trust centers, right? So
yeah, and I would imagine someone I'm thinking about my autistic relatives who they're, and I'm not saying this is the case for everyone, but thinking more black or white, very direct path might feel so much risk in disclosing at all. And it's not even a matter of trust and distrust, but knowing that once it's shared, there are so many implications with the word autism. And the standards that people expect of them could change, like so many things could change. It is really hard. And this is where I think about so many factors like leadership, trust, power, that in the workplace are part of the environment in which someone is potentially going to take a risk and disclose. And yes, of course, like I said earlier, the person who is living with and managing and being brilliant in the world with a neurodivergence, they're the only ones who can really disclose something like that in the workplace. Yet leadership has a responsibility to make the workplace a place where someone can feel comfortable sharing what is enough for them without feeling the need to overshare or hold back. And this is where power is really important to think about.
So I wonder if then, do we share our diagnosis or do we just share the type of environment where we know we'll be more successful? So can I go to my manager and say, hey, I respond better to things that interest me without necessarily saying, hey, I have ADHD, right? Is that a way to navigate around the stigma of the neurodivergence?
I think that's a great idea. Like so usually, you know, in most of my leadership roles, when I assume the role of leading a team or someone new, I hired someone new, in the part of the onboarding process, I had a series of questions that I would ask. Questions about their personal values, what's deeply important to them, and also questions about how they prefer to work, whether they like to work in the mornings or in the evenings, if they like to work more independently, if they need a heads up about the meeting agenda before the meeting to prepare, whether they like novelty or ideation, or they like manning the plane, all of those things, right? And I think when leaders invite that kind of dialogue, it makes it easier for the team member to talk about what they need. That said, if a team member, someone new joins the team and immediately begins blurting out everything that they need, totally, absolutely, they're right. And I highly recommend that. But then how might leadership perceive that? Is this person coming in here on the team? I just hired them and they're already making demands. This is why power is important. When it comes to creating an environment of trust, the leader, the person with the most power, has the responsibility to go first, to extend trust, to set the table for a climate of trust. And you know, trust is such a hard topic because it's, for some people, it's a moral issue, or it could be a personal value, or it can be very emotional. And trust is also an emotional experience. And also, trust is a set of leadership competencies. And that means that leaders can develop their trust building skills to create the kind of team and environment where it's easier for someone to say what they need to be successful, or if they want to disclose, like, hey, I have ADHD. Or I math different, or whatever it is.
Let's back the truck up a little bit, because I want to hit that point again when you say, and I want you to repeat from this point, trust is a set of competencies. Trust is not one competency, right?
It is absolutely a set. And then I'm going to borrow here from the work of Charles Feltman. He wrote The Thin Book of Trust. Highly recommend reading it. We'll include a link in the show notes. But first, I'll start with the definition of trust that I have adopted from his work. And that is that trust is choosing to make something I care about vulnerable to another person's actions. And it's, yes, it's emotional. It's a moral issue, all of that. But trust is choosing to make something I care about vulnerable to someone else. And disclosing, I would imagine, one's neurodivergence, because hopefully they care about themselves, is choosing to make a part of themselves vulnerable to someone else. And so that someone else, if they're a leader, they have the responsibility to develop the skills. And using Feltman's framework, which I love because it's super simple and easy to apply, trust is built, assessed, and generally in four different dimensions. The first one is care. Care is, do you care about me as a person? Or at the very least, even if you don't like me, do you at least care about the shared interests of the team, our shared goals, whatever that is? The second one is sincerity. Do you mean what you say? Do you say what you mean? Are you transparent and honest to the extent that you can? Of course, sometimes leadership has to keep certain things back, right? The third thing is reliability. Do you follow through on your commitments? Do you show up when you say you're going to show up? Or if you can't, do you at least communicate it and renegotiate? And the fourth dimension is competence. Do you have the skills to do what you're expected to do? Or if, you know, you're partially competent, are you upfront about it? So when I think of those four dimensions, leaders can learn to build trust in each of those different ways. I do want to highlight that the dimension of care is correlated with psychological safety. For someone to say, here are the things that I need to work effectively or at my best, or to go as far as saying, hey, I'm autistic and I want you to know, there needs to be sufficient psychological safety that the level of risk required, that sense of risk, is reduced. And leadership sets the tone on that.
That's a lot of great, helpful information. And I absolutely agree. Leadership sets the tone. And when you say leadership, you're not talking like my boss or my boss's boss. You're talking the very top of the company, the very top of the organization, because it is that CEO, that C-suite that casts that shadow down to everybody else. And if you don't have buy, so even if you had that buy-in from your boss or your boss's boss, you know, your VP or director or whomever, but their boss didn't really exhibit that trust or whatever, like it's a deal breaker, right? Because you got to trust in the culture of the entire organization. And it's that ultimate leadership level, the people that are actually managing the direction of the company, that sets that tone.
Oh, completely agree. With that said, that doesn't excuse frontline and middle management from not developing the trust building skills and the culture of trust, right? And I'll share from my experience as the leader, from the leader's point of view, like the people on my team who have shared with me about their neurodivergence, like they shared it with me. They didn't share it with the CEO. They came to me. And so that means that I had a responsibility to earn their trust for them to feel a reduced sense of risk and make the choice to tell me so that I can best support them. But it does take a culture. Like culture is like the oxygen in the air. If strategy is what a company or a team is going to do, culture is how it gets done. And if the culture, which is set from the top, is not one in which psychological safety and trust are valued, then leadership hasn't earned the trust required for someone to disclose.
I totally agree with you. But then we get into the difficult situation, because whether or not to disclose, like that's a very heavy topic that someone has to consider. And you have to just consider the pros and the cons, right? And when looking at that balance, if you don't disclose or continue, you know, masking to try to fit your personalities, the round peg into the square hole, right? That invites conflict. You're going to be at the end of that conflict and have to deal with it, or you're creating conflict with your coworkers, or, you know, the stress that comes with that, the burnout potentially that you're heading towards by constantly trying to keep your head above water and avoid the rejection and try to fit your way of thinking into the neurotypical world, right? So that's a really tough one when there's not that feeling of trust or emotional safety in the workplace. Like that's got to be a very difficult place for someone with ADHD to even talk about like how they work, or because again, that's opening the door to criticism, right? The rejection.
It is, again, like going to that definition of trust, choosing to make something I care about vulnerable to another person's actions goes both ways. Either one chooses to share their work preferences or disclose their diagnosis, right? Or their assessment is that I can't, there isn't enough safety here for me to say anything. And therefore, I'm choosing to not share. And I'm going to carry this on my own. And I'll share an example of someone who is a friend who wrestled with whether to say something. And the way that people perceived him at work was that he seemed aloof. He doesn't make eye contact. He takes over the meetings. And this is feedback that he had received over and over. Feedback he received in coaching, even in after, you know, not getting roles after an interview. This was very consistent feedback. And he wrestled with like, do I just tell them that I'm autistic? Mm-hmm. And there was so much at stake for him. It was very, very, very heavy for him. He and I talked a lot about how to approach that. And I supported him with thinking through, similar to what you said, being explicit about his work needs to work at his best without specifically saying that he's autistic. And then what it would be like to just upfront and just share with leadership that he's autistic. What's interesting was that eventually he felt enough connection with his manager to share, hey, I'm autistic. With that understanding, people were able to support him and understand him very differently. The feedback that he received about not making consistent eye contact was, instead of thinking, oh, he's just aloof or disinterested, people understood he's interested. It's just that the way he communicates it with body language is different than most other people here. people came to understand that his ability to solve really weird problems creatively and then be really excited wasn't that he meant to cram his decision down everybody's throats. It's just that he was really excited and that was it, right? And so that allowed the people around him to support him and see him differently. But it hinged on his leadership, creating the safety. And it took him, I want to say, a couple of years to feel that safety combined with courage to say, hey, I'm autistic.
That's a great example to making me kind of reexamine how even myself as a leader made assumptions about people in the past. So we talk about in our last episode, even with your sensibilities, not recognizing this in others, like, I wonder, I bet there have been employees on my teams and people that I have been in a position of like helping and developing where I could have been more sensitive to their needs, right?
And I can think of a time where I was not at my best and I didn't know what I didn't know, but there was someone on my team who his level of precision and perfection was admirable. Like his work was, pristine. And that was great. His testing, oh my gosh, systems testing, not a single defect will get past this guy. And he was amazing and he was recognized for it. And that's what helped me really successful. I completely missed the signs that he was struggling with obsessive compulsive disorder. I could have done more to make work, not to change him at all, right? Not to try and change him or not try and make him fit into the expectations, but to make work a little easier for him where he was putting an extra effort that was not required.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up this example because it kind of touches on something that inspired the whole impetus of this podcast, right? Because it's not just for people to have ADHD in the workplace. It's for people that work with them and manage them, right? And in that example where you got this great employee, you missed the signs, I don't know that it's necessarily that you missed the signs as much as it is that you weren't equipped with the skills to spot the signs.
And that's fair. At that time, it was really early in the management part of my career, so I didn't know what I didn't know. But that said, there are signs that more experienced me can see that I couldn't see then. For example, the working a whole bunch of extra hours and delivering something pristine. Of course, I focus on, oh my gosh, your work is pristine. It is flawless. You launch with zero defects. You launch with, 99.99% up rate, all of that stuff. And I was so focused on the outcome that at the time, I wasn't paying attention to his work process. Mm-hmm. And I could have seen where I could have stepped in to help him not work. It's not just about not working as much. If someone's inspired, go for it, right? But have more work-life harmony to focus on his health instead of thinking that he had to maintain this level of perfection. And I gave myself grace because I didn't know what I didn't know. Eventually, he and I we were on the same team for a long time, and eventually he shared with me, and it was really cool to be able to support him. But as a leader, there is a responsibility to notice, to really see people, not just the outcome, not just their output, but to see the person in front of you, whether physically or, virtually. It is important to be able to see the person and notice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I can think back to a time in my leadership experience where I would see something like that. And my inclination would be to invite them to share with the rest of the team exactly what they're doing. Like, hey, tell us your process. How are you getting zero defects? Like, share with everybody. Right?
What's your magic? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, oh, wait, no, never mind.
Maybe this isn't the healthiest way to work, right?
Yeah.
And so it is important to be aware of the impact of power, whether it is, positional power because someone is somewhere higher in the organization chart, or maybe it's a team lead. They're not formally the manager, but they have a lot of influence and power in that team to be able to notice other people and pay attention. But even then, it is about the culture in which people can talk about trust and are conscious of demonstrating care, being reliable, competent, sincere, so that people feel, and not just on paper, but truly feel that the psychological safety and that sense of belonging that makes it easier to say, hey, I have a hard time logging in at 8 a.m. and I may need a little bit more time. Or even, hey, I enjoy our team meeting. I want to be engaged, but it would be easier for me to be engaged if I got a heads up on the agenda items so that I can prepare my thoughts. Those details can make such a big difference in how everyone is able to bring their best, but they're hard to share when leadership has not earned the trust and when the culture of trust is absent.
And I would even add to that when trust has already been broken, either through intentional actions or not, right? Because once it's been broken, it's harder to get back than it was to gain it in the first place.
Absolutely. And
so that's why starting from a positive foot is so important. So going back to what you, how we started this conversation, you said, you know, when you bring on a new employee, you have a conversation, not just about what motivates them, but their work style, right? Like, what hours do you prefer working? And do you prefer email, phone calls? Like, how do you like your feedback? Do you like public formal recognition or private pat on the shoulder, right? It's so important to set the tone from the get-go and to keep that always in your mind as you go. It's not a box that you check to say, okay, I had that conversation, great, I know what they like, right? You got to keep re-earning that trust, right? It's not a piggy bank. It's a stream that flows.
Or maybe it is a piggy bank, right? Where you're constantly depositing, but also debiting.
Ah, yeah.
Maybe it is like, you know, there's an analogy.
Double-sided accounting, yeah.
Exactly, right? So trust is constantly depositing into the piggy bank nuggets of care, sincerity, reliability, competence. And yes, there may be debits from time to time, maybe a tough conversation or something didn't go as well or a disagreement or a conflict that felt a little personal. But when there is enough in the piggy bank, a small withdrawal makes it easy to make up. That said, if someone straight up breaks the bank, where it's not just trust was eroded a little bit, but it was completely damaged, that is very different. It's very possible to come back. Again, that is a set of leadership skills to have the courageous conversations and acknowledge what is happening and re-engage skillfully in trust building behavior. Mm-hmm. But during all of that, I what comes to mind is someone who maybe has a hard time with seeing trust as a set of dimensions and spectrums. And to them, it's I trust or I don't trust, which black or white on off switch can be not only really difficult for a team to recover, but also personally isolating. It can be a little lonely, right? But for someone being aware that for someone whose brain operates more direct black or white, that trust repair needs to look a little different for them than trying to repair trust with someone who's more neurotypical.
Because some people, you know, I've heard the word transactional. They're very transactional in their relationships. And I've heard that word thrown around and with a negative connotation, right? But no, some people are black or white, right? There's not a lot of gray area or give in between. So going back to the topic of whether or not to disclose, I think we agree that trust is huge. And the biggest thing leaders can do is to build an environment of trust. And I think it's a lot more difficult when that environment of trust is not there. It's a very personal decision that the discloser, the person with the ADHD, whether or not to disclose. And
I want to add something to that, though, and that is, yes, and getting back to that disclosure, I think it's also important to think about what happens in the moment of disclosure if the person chooses to and what happens after. And in the moment of disclosure, it is not, let me back up. There are laws, state and federal laws in the United States. If someone is in a different country, I'm sure your country has something too. But there are laws that talk about protection, especially when the issue could be categorized as a disability. Hear me, y'all. Law is the minimum standard. That is the lowest bar. As a leader, our job is not just to meet the minimum standard. It is to do more than that. It is to lead. So with that, in the moment of disclosure, it is so important to honor the risk that a person has chosen to take to tell you. And then when they tell you, to treat that with a lot of care and respect. And then after, to continue to re-earn that person's trust all the time. It's not just, okay, cool, I know, you know, you have ADHD, I know you're autistic or whatever it is, right? It's also to demonstrate care in an ongoing way. And whether it is help working, collaborating with the individual to redesign work in a way that works for them and realistically in a way that works for the organization, right? Or it might be understanding when they make specific requests or encouraging the entire team to be open to different work styles, to maximize the benefits of different work styles and diversity on the team and minimize the unhealthy conflict that can sometimes happen from differences. So that trust and that care needs to happen, not just to enable someone to disclose what they need or their diagnosis, but also after that point, to make it a place where everyone can bring the best version of themselves to work.
And I think timing is kind of an important question to talk about trust. You know, as the person disclosing, after you miss a commitment or failed on something, like maybe that's not the time to disclose, because it looks like you're making excuses, right? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's a really good point because I think it's important to time it. One, take care of yourself. Like I think about our nervous systems. Our nervous systems need four things to be healthy. And that's air, water, rest, and glucose. Make sure that your nervous system is a resource for a tender conversation. So prepare, right? And then also time it well so that it is not on the heels of feedback or maybe this is the topic of the conversation, not an add-on to another conversation.
You want it to be its own thing. Like the gravity of the conversation deserves its own subject line, right?
For sure. And I think about the times when people who are on my team and have shared about their neurodivergence, neurospiciness, even mental health challenges and needs, that needed to be its own conversation. Because as a leader, it was my responsibility to hold space and to listen and to not tell the person what I'm going to do for them, but to co-create with them the changes that they would need or the environment that they need. This is not about taking infringing on someone's autonomy or stepping on their agency. It is the opposite. It is about collaborating together for what they need and what the team needs as a whole.
Even if you fit that into like the textbook definition of management where you plan, organize, lead, and control, like that is the basic job is to... plan, organize, lead, and control for your team, remove the obstacles. And this is one of those obstacles, right?
And you know, obstacles, but then also maybe it could be an obstacle, but maybe it's something that just is, right?
Yeah. Well, I meant like a psychological obstacle, right? Like
For the individual. Yeah. That definitely makes sense. And like if a leader's job is to my definition of leadership, which I borrow from other smarter people, is leadership is the process of people influencing one another toward a shared outcome. Mm-hmm. And in that process of influence, there's give and take, exchanges. Through dialogue, we create a shared understanding. And that is part of planning, like understanding what are we working with as far as, you know, money, time, software, whatever. But then from a human perspective, what are the strengths that each person brings to the table? What are the needs that each person has to work at their best? And planning and acting, organizing accordingly.
Yeah. And I just want to point out that we have we use two different words, but we are not using them interchangeably. There is managing and there is leading. They are very separate things. A manager has the title. A leader doesn't necessarily have the title.
Yes.
You can be a manager and a leader at the same time. And if you're someone in the workplace that's thinking about disclosing an ADHD diagnosis or having the tough conversation around what type of environment you might perform best in, you know, that's one of the signs you can kind of look at. Is your boss just a manager? Or are they just, you know, planning and organizing and checking the boxes, working towards the goals? And or are they a leader? Do they inspire? Do you feel like you would follow them anywhere?
That is a word. And using that trust framework that I talked about earlier, you can also use that to assess whether it is safe to disclose or how much. And look at the people in your team and who your leader or manager is. Do they demonstrate care about you and about the team? Or at least at the very least about the shared goals? Are they sincere? Are they honest? Are they transparent to the extent they can be? You know, I'm not saying are they breaking NDAs, but are they transparent and honest to the extent they can be? Are they reliable? Are they competent? You can use those four aspects of trust to assess, is there enough safety here that I can share with this person what I need, or I can share my diagnosis or a combination of both? Use this framework to your advantage to help you trust wisely, so that it doesn't have to be all or nothing, but you can trust and make a decision that is informed, yes, by emotions, but also by four distinct dimensions of trust.
Yeah. And maybe you can even start small, right? Maybe you ask or explain that you think better in the mornings, or, hey, can we have our one-on-ones in the afternoons? Like I'm, you know, more active and awake or alert, or whatever you want to put in there. You could always start small, make your request and see how they respond, kind of test the waters a little bit.
Yeah. See if they respond with care, or if they commit to you. Yes. You know what? Yes. I'll do my best to send the team meeting agenda in advance so you can prepare. Do they actually follow through? And pay attention to that so that you have evidence on which to base whether to trust. But as a call out to leaders, remember, leaders, you extend trust first and you are responsible for earning trust first. This has been such a good and juicy conversation. And thank you so much, Andrew. And for everyone listening, do want to remind you of the resources. Check out the trust framework, specifically the Thin Book of Trust. It is literally a thin book. It was written so that you can read it on a short flight, but super actionable. And as we wrap up this episode of Different at Work, we want to thank you. Thank you for joining us. We hope that you keep being you, different at work.
Hi, one final note. We are not mental health professionals, and nothing you hear on this podcast is meant to replace therapy, diagnosis, or professional care. We are just two people sharing what we've lived and learned. If today's episode brought something up for you, or you're just looking for support, visit our website at differentatwork.com for additional resources. Again, that's differentatwork.com. Just click the resources tab. Goodbye.